So, greetings, friends. I'm starting today's podcast a little bit early, almost 4 hours early. I have a lot of preparations to do today for our spring retreat that begins tomorrow, so I need to do this a little bit early. So those of you that watch it live, you'll be getting it recorded. And this is the second talk this week on the Pali Canon. I gave the first talk last night at our center in Frenchtown, on the Pali Canon. I just posted a new article on the Pali Canon and the maintenance of the authenticity, and it truly is a remarkable story, and I won't get into the whole introduction that I gave last night. That's already posted on the podcast, and it's also on the website. And this talk is based on the next to last chapter in my new book, Becoming Buddha. And it's the article in a chapter explains why we can have confidence in the preserved teachings of the Buddha in the second book of the Pali Canon, the Sutta Pitaka, because of how that has been originally established and then maintained over the 2,600 years since the Buddha's passing. And it really is a most remarkable story. And I won't go over that again. It's in the first talk that's already posted. So I'm going to begin this talk about halfway through the article. And I one of the things that I touched on in the first three Buddhist councils, and actually all the Buddhist councils, was how, beginning with the Second Council, there was a strong desire by, at the time, a very small sect called the Mahasanghikas that wanted to introduce a more magical and mystical Dharma as opposed to what the Buddha taught. They wanted to establish the Buddha as a god, which is something he never portrayed himself at, and as one god among an infinite number of Buddha gods, stretching infinitely back into the past and infinitely forward into the future. And they also wanted to establish that the Buddha's life itself was simply an apparition. And when you understand the differences that have taken place, the adaptations and accommodations that have been made to the Buddha's original teachings, that really was a necessary point to make, that the Buddha's life was just an apparition and he was a god and just one god among many gods and a supernatural being. And that has allowed for all the changes that have taken place over the years. And that is really the most significant point to be made. And the article itself gets into much more detail about that. And it was between the... it was at the Second Council that a monk, his name was Tissa, T-I-S-S-A, who was part of what would become modern Theravadan Buddhism, objected to what the Mahasanghikas were doing and censured them and introduced some other teachings that they were more fond of. And between the Second and the Third Council, the Theravadins became more entrenched in their way, and the Mahasanghikas and other sects now are starting to pop up. And it's really between the Second and the Third Council that the differences and the divisiveness within Buddhism was firmly established. And it was during that time also that the original Sangha really lost their identity. And that doesn't mean that there weren't people that continued to practice the direct teachings of the Buddha without any additions, and they're still today, including what we do at Cross River Meditation Center and what's in my books and on my website. And also at that time, it was the beginning of the introduction of the Abhidhamma, and it wasn't well established at the Second Council, but by the Third Council, the Abhidhamma was now included as the third book in the Pali Canon. And that's where I'm going to start this talk today. But it's important to understand, that the Abhidhamma was not part of the original canon from between the first and the Second Council. There was only two books. There was a Vinayapitaka, the accounting of the general rules, often called the discipline, and the Suttapitaka, the direct teachings of the Buddha, which is often called the Dhamma and the discipline. And it wasn't until much later that the Abhidhamma was introduced. The Abhidhamma is, most all scholars would agree, if you just go on the language, that it couldn't have been a direct teaching of the Buddha. But there's many contradictions and inconsistencies in the Abhidhamma and what the Buddha taught. The Abhidhamma seeks to explain the creation of the world. It greatly adapts and really ignores the Buddha's teaching on dependent origination to then allow for this grand creation myth. It all gets into very intricate psychological explanations of consciousness. Some people find it helpful. I don't. I find all the direction and guidance I need in the Buddha's direct teachings. And again, I'm not putting down, I always have to give this disclaimer, I'm not putting down anything that has developed as different Buddhist religions. They're all legitimate. There is a difficulty in some of the claims that are made that they are direct teachings of the Buddha, and I leave that up to every individual to decide. But I also think it's important to understand the genesis and the provenance of the Buddha's teaching. And when you look at what was presented in the Suttapitaka and compare it to what has been developed since then, there's no way to reconcile the different inconsistencies and direct contradictions unless you accept the fact that the Buddha was a supernatural being, that he presented his teachings both in a physical form and a non-physical form, and that those teachings that were presented in a non-physical form are quite different than what he actually spent in a physical body teaching. Now, I don't find much usefulness in the teachings that the Buddha gave in non-physical form, and I find extremely useful teachings in the words that have been preserved in the Suttapitaka. Again, I'm not putting down any other religion, and I'm going to get into what has developed. Beginning with another explanation of the Abhidhamma. So, and I'm reading from the article. It is told that the origin of the Abhidhamma occurred when the Buddha, in the seventh year after his awakening, left the physical world for the realm of the Devas. There, for the next 3 months, he taught what would become this third book of the canon. The Abhidhamma became an unintended link between Theravada and the developing Mahasanghika-influenced Mahayana schools, and that the Abhidhamma is an essential influence in many of the modern Theravadan and Mahayana schools. The Mahayana schools don't place a great importance on it, but you can see, and I'll cite the suttas in just a short while, you can see the direct influence that the Abhidhamma had on later developed schools. And it was really in that the license first taken at the Second Council and then developed even further in the Third Council that has led to the development of modern Buddhism. So in a little over a century between the Second and Third Council, the liberty taken by the Mahasanghikas and to a lesser degree the Theravadins in the Second Buddhist Council had altered the Buddha's original teachings in such a way that today these teachings are often, meaning the Buddha's original teachings, are often diminished in importance or they're completely dismissed. And the Buddha's direct teachings are either presented as anachronistic and so not all that important, or that they are of such a simple character that they're really not worth even looking at, and that the Buddha in his supernatural disincarnate form is when he really presented the real Dharma, meaning advanced Dharma. And it's presented that way, that he did that so that they would be preserved for a time in the future when human beings were advanced enough to actually understand what he was teaching in these higher realms. And of course, there's no way to disprove that's not what happened. But again, it's so contradictory to what he taught. What that's implying is that this awakened human being spent the final 45 years of his life teaching nearly every day, but teaching something that is presented today as almost completely worthless, or at least so simplistic that it's just the beginning to the modern dharmas, and it's hardly ever even considered as useful. Now, I spent many, many years in modern Buddhist lineages, and there was very, very little talk of the Four Noble Truths or the Eightfold Path. When they were talked about, they were talked about in ways that are so inconsistent to what the Buddha actually taught as preserved in the Sutta Pitaka. There were great license taken with the Buddha's teachings on dependent origination to use that as a grand creation myth, and the Buddha's teachings on emptiness went from a direct action, meaning that we need to recognize, develop the Four Noble Truths so that we can empty ourselves of ignorance of Four Noble Truths and awaken, to now emptiness is taught as a almost as a destination to discover as a reality. In other words, the emptiness as it portrayed in the modern sutras is more of a destination, more of a noun than a verb as the Buddha used it. So this has led to a modern Buddhism to be a thicket of competing views and bewildering contradictions. These bewildering contradictions have themselves become a part of Buddhist lore and presented as the intricate tapestry of all dharmas. So again, modern Buddhism was often portrayed as it's so difficult to understand, it's so deep, so intricate, so mystical and so magical and so esoteric that it takes endless lifetimes, endless eons to fully understand that. And the Buddha taught a Dhamma during his lifetime in a physical body as an awakened man that could be developed in this present lifetime, and that was a point of his teaching, so that we could awaken or gain full human maturity in this present lifetime. And that, when I finally looked at the teachings that were contained in the Sutta Pitaka, it changed everything about my Buddhist practice, and I can honestly say that it completely changed my life. So that intricate tapestry of all dharmas and given authority by claiming the same basic philosophy and all leading to the same conclusions. And there's a very well-known and I think very sincere modern teachers. I was surprised that one came out who's written quite a few books talking about a basic non-dogmatic non-religious Dhamma, and I won't say his name, but he recently came out in Tricycle Magazine and said that even though there's some differences between the schools, they all have the same basic premise and they all lead to the same place. And of course, that's just simply not true. Most of modern Buddhism is the Bodhisattva path, and I talked a lot about this in last night's talk, so I won't get into it deeper. But there's a significant difference between the Bodhisattva path, and the path to arahantship, to full human awakening, to full human maturity, between that path that the Buddha taught and what has developed later. And again, when you trace this back to the Second Council, you can see where that divergence came and why now the Bodhisattva path was substituted for the path to arahantship, and they're two completely different paths. Again, I'm not diminishing the Bodhisattva path, and I guess I should talk about that. The Buddha consistently referred to himself prior to his awakening as an unawakened Bodhisattva, or as Bodhisattva. There's another article on my website, and it's included in the book on the Nagara Sutta, where the Buddha describes his awakening in detail, in relation to dependent origination, as he taught dependent origination, and in relation to the five clinging aggregates. And he repeatedly refers to himself as an unawakened Bodhisattva. And he did that throughout the Sutta Pitakas. And again, it's not to denigrate the Bodhisattva path. And what the Buddha is referring to when he's calling himself a Bodhisattva is a very highly evolved human being with a very highly evolved sense of compassion, but still lacking understanding of Four Noble Truths. In other words, lacking a profound sense of wisdom. And why that's so important is that lacking that wisdom, you can have all the compassion in the world, but there's going to be many times when you'll be compromised in that presentation of that because you don't understand the true nature of what's occurring. And again, I won't get too much deeper into that. But again, there's a significant difference between the past. The first Mahayana texts or sutras appeared around the first century of the Common Era. This is also the time when a somewhat magical and mystical idea of receiving the Dhamma through a mind-to-mind transmission developed. The idea of mind-to-mind transmission may have developed to account for the split in the continuity of the Dhamma, as well as teachings between the different branches. A supernatural Buddha is obviously necessary to establish a mind-only Dharma transmission and a mind-only meditation method and lineage. And of course, the Buddha never taught any of that. If that was the case, if it was even possible, the Buddha would have simply meditated, awakened, and spent the rest of his life under a tree giving these mind-to-mind transmissions. But he didn't do that. He taught individuals directly, and as those individuals developed understanding, he sent them around northern India to, again, spread the Dhamma. If it was possible to do this mind-to-mind thing, and by the way, every school that I ever studied in that practiced mind-to-mind transmission, that was all that they practiced. They didn't include any of the other teachings, or they did in such a cursory way that they presented it as not really the path, just maybe something to consider. And again, the Buddha did not present the Dhamma that way. And so that once that split has taken place and you allow for a mind-to-mind transmission or a supernatural Buddha, then anything is possible. And so even though there's no direct link now back to the Buddha, every modern lineage still claims a direct link back to the Buddha, because now there's this supernatural Buddha that you can attach yourself to or cling to. With the introduction of sutras, and I make a distinction between suttas are what the Buddha taught as preserved in the Sutta Pitaka, and sutras are what have developed later and what modern Buddhism relies on. So modern Buddhism relies on primarily four sutras that I'll talk about in just a minute, as opposed to the suttas that are contained in the Sutta Pitaka. Now the Theravadins continue to rely on the suttas as are presented in the Sutta Pitaka, but they also include the Abhidhamma, and that Abhidhamma has allowed for, even within the Theravadin community, for some pretty significant adaptations to the original teachings. And again, I keep saying this disclaimer, I'm not putting down any particular school or sect, I'm certainly not putting down the Theravadins, but just to recognize that even what they practice today is in some ways significantly different. And it's mostly because of the inclusion of the Abhidhamma as part of their Dhamma practice. But also the modern Vipassana movement, which is considered part of the Theravadin school, if you will, arose just in the last, I'm not quite sure the actual historical beginning, but around 80 years ago, by a gentleman named Kim, who was a government servant in Burma, and wanted to introduce meditation to that working people in Burma. But he was not interested, and maybe he felt that they wouldn't be interested either, of really talking or teaching the entire Buddhist path. So he taught this hybridized type of meditation that was later taken up by the Sayadaws and made very popular worldwide now. I'm not quite sure of the numbers, but the Vipassana movement is one of the fastest growing and probably most influential movements in modern Buddhism. But it is just that. It's a hybridized meditation practice, and it's mostly stripped bare of everything that the Buddha taught. Obviously, it has a lot of popularity with modern Western Buddhists, because they don't have to develop anything. It's just taught as a rather intense meditation practice. There's an article on the website, quite a few, on the Buddha taught Shamatha Vipassana meditation for his entire teaching career. It's the only meditation method he ever taught. And he emphasized over and over again the importance of practicing. Shamatha means to quiet the mind, Vipassana means to gain insight, to practicing both of those in tandem. And so the Vipassana movement, usually how it's presented on their 10-day retreats, is they'll use Shamatha, or mindfulness of the breath, to quiet the mind. And usually the first couple days or 3 days, you'll use that method. And then they'll discard that and just use this type of analytical insight meditation, in a way that the focus of that insight isn't even what the Buddha was looking for, which is insight into the three marks of existence and their interrelationship. So again, I don't want to get too deep, and I'm not putting down the Vipassana movement. It's just something different, and that's part of the Theravadan school. And again, that has the legitimacy given to that, again, can be traced back to the Second Buddhist Council, where license was taken to the Buddhist teachings. And in modern Buddhism today, most everyone will still hang their hat on that. That didn't the Buddha say that we should question everything and change it to fit our views? And of course, he never said that. In the last chapter in the book is the Kalama Sutta, which is one of the suttas that modern teachers say that refer to as saying the Buddha did say in that that we should question everything and adapt it to fit our views. And of course, if those views are rooted in ignorance, which is what dependent origination says, from ignorance to 12 observable causative links, all manner of suffering arises, meaning dukkha, which refers to the Four Noble Truths. If we're adapting our views, those views are still rooted in ignorance, and what will follow can only be more ignorant views. Again, not putting down what's developed, but these are the Buddhist teachings. So let me get back to the article. With the introduction of sutras, teachings that are even given the authority of a teaching of the Buddha, the intent and purpose of the actual path of the Buddhist teachings has been altered, and the alterations and accommodations to the original Dhamma have become further obscured. And that's certainly true. And again, all you have to do is look at what was included in the suttas, what the Buddha's intent, and I get more into this in this article, what the Buddha's intent was in teaching that. It's very, very clear that what has developed wasn't something that the Buddha taught in his lifetime. And again, we're everybody's free to follow whatever they want. But the reason why I always make a distinction, because I think it's so important that if we're going to practice something that we call Buddhism, we should at least know what is included in the Sutta Pitaka and what is considered by many the authentic teachings of the Buddha. And again, the article gets more into that authentication, and last night's talk talks more about that. So some of the most influential sutras in Mahayana Buddhism directly contradict the Buddhist teachings as preserved in the Pali Canon. The Heart Sutra, which appears around 600 prior to the or post the Common Era, some date it maybe a little bit earlier, some maybe a little bit later, but at least 800 to 1400 years after the Buddha's passing. And it's actually taught by the Hindu god, Avalokiteshvara. And again, I don't want to get too deep into this and get off topic. When the Buddha was studying with two teachers, Alara Kalama and Udeka Ramaputta, and rejected both of those teachers, those were the two prominent spiritual teachers, and I use that term loosely, of the Buddha's time. And he studied with them, mastered their teachings, and rejected both of those teachings. And both of those teachers were teaching a dharma that was loosely based on the Vedas, which was the precursor to modern Hinduism, and even during the Buddha's lifetime, that continued to develop. And the reason why I'm saying that is much of modern Buddhism is more akin to what was included in the Vedas and modern Hinduism than what the Buddha taught. And what he taught was a rejection of that. Again, I'm not putting it down. It's just what developed. And so the Heart Sutra is based on this Hindu god teaching to Sariputta, one of the Buddha's monks. And that's interesting to me that they include in that sutra what was historically known as one of the most important monks in the Buddha Sangha. But there's no accounting of this in the Sutta Pitaka, which besides the contradictions, you would think that that would be a pretty important thing to include, but it's not. So anyway, Avalokiteshvara taught Sariputta, who was one of the senior monks of the original Sangha. He teaches the Dharma using emptiness as a theme, but in a way that contradicts the Buddha's meaning of emptiness, which was to empty oneself of ignorance, to empty oneself of clinging to ignorant views. which is what he talked about in the very first his very first teaching in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. And everything the Buddha taught for the entire 45 years of his teaching career was taught in that context. In the Heart Sutra, the Four Noble Truths, these are direct words in the sutra, the Four Noble Truths are dismissed as there is only emptiness and there is no path, and that the Heart Sutra contains the ultimate truth of emptiness and non-attachment. It also starts beginning into getting to this non-dual thinking, which is something the Buddha didn't teach. This is also the text that the Bodhisattva ideal is presented as the highest path in Buddhism, and again diminishes the Four Noble Truths, which includes the Eightfold Path, as the Arahant path that the Buddha taught. The Buddha consistently referred to himself prior to his awakening as an unawakened Bodhisattva. And I mentioned that before, so I'm not going to read that anymore right now. There is also an adaptation in the Heart Sutra of the five clinging aggregates, describing them as merely empty phenomena, rather than something, and this is such an important teaching of the Buddha, to develop an understanding of it, not simply to dismiss them that they're empty, but again, to adapt the Buddha's teaching to this more mystical way. You have to portray the five clinging aggregates as something that is not even used looking at. It's just empty phenomena. So while it can be argued that the five clinging aggregates are true due to the impermanent nature of all phenomena, it is an extreme view that lacks the context of the Buddha's use of five clinging aggregates to describe the real and human experience of personal disappointment and suffering. So the five clinging aggregates are just that. It describes the personal experience of suffering. And there's a lot more material about that on my website and also in my new book, Becoming Buddha. The Heart Sutra teaches emptiness as a to be realized all-pervasive experience of reality rather than to develop the Eightfold Path to empty oneself from all self-referential views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The direct dismissal of the Four Noble Truths is another example of using a conceptual application of emptiness to directly dismiss what an awakened human being spent the last 45 years of his life teaching. And in that way, the human being that became the Buddha doesn't need any defense of me. But I think it's very insulting to his Dhamma to portray it this way, that and basically saying that everything the Buddha taught while he was alive was just a waste of time, and is something that we can dismiss as empty of any real value, or even as a direct example of emptiness. The Diamond Sutra follows a similar theme as the Heart Sutra and appears around 500 in the Common Era. The Diamond Sutra expands the theme of emptiness and continues to elevate the Bodhisattva path as a superior path and further alters dependent origination from a direct teaching on ignorance of Four Noble Truths, and now as the originating condition of dukkha, to a vague creation myth, and the Diamond Sutra gets very intricate in that. The Diamond Sutra is an excellent example of the adaptation and accommodation of the teachings preserved in the suttas, having a loose resemblance to the themes the Buddha taught, but adapted to fit the purpose of the Bodhisattva ideal and conceptual meaning of emptiness. And if you look at any one of these sutras that I'm mentioning now, and compare them to dependent origination and the Buddha's first three teachings, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, and the Fire Discourse, all of this is in the book Becoming Buddha, by the way. It's clear, and it's an interesting study, when you look at them side by side, the significant inconsistencies and contradictions. And to me, that's very interesting in recognizing how conditioned thinking, going back to the Second Buddhist Council, continues to condition the Buddhist teaching till today. And again, I'm not putting down what has developed in that time. Many millions of people practice it and find benefit from it. I didn't. And the only thing I'm saying here in these talks and in my books and in my teachings is it's important to recognize these differences. The most significant difference between the Buddha's direct teachings and the Mahayana doctrine is presented in the Lotus Sutra. In the Lotus Sutra, the Bodhisattva path is presented again as the more advanced path, and the Arahant path, the Eightfold Path, is directly told as an inferior path to awakening. And again, think about that. That's the path that the Buddha taught. And just dismissing it that way, it's surprising to me. And I guess the reason why it's so surprising to me is that my introduction and my many, many years was in the Mahayana schools, and I simply got more confused and more frustrated. And most of what was taught like a carrot on a stick, that it just takes many, many lifetimes of intense study, and eventually you'll realize your own inner Buddha nature. And I went along with it because so many people were saying it. But it was really out of confusion and frustration. I said, this can't be what a human, an awakened human being taught. And that's when I looked at the Sutta Pitakas, and that's what made all the difference. And I realized that the Buddha, at least if you believe the later stories, then the human being who would become the Buddha taught a much more useful and effective path for me than anything that followed afterwards. And that's really the point that I'm trying to make, that if you're going to study Buddhism and put your life's work in it, or even if you just dabble in it, at least learn what the Buddha taught as preserved in the Sutta Pitaka and decide for yourself, which is exactly how the Buddha taught when other teachers were teaching different teachings during his time. And his students would come to him and say, we learned this and we learned that. This is explained in the Kalama Sutta. How do we decide? The Buddha said, you have to develop my Dhamma if you're going to understand it, and then you can choose for yourself. So the Lotus Sutra is a foundational text of many of the modern schools, the Chan, Zen, Shon, Tentai, Nichiren, Pure Land, and is even referenced in Tibetan Buddhist religions. Though there are many actors in the Lotus Sutra that are common to actors in the Sutta Pitaka, it is commonly agreed that the Lotus Sutra was first developed around the beginning of the Common Era and it added to over the next few hundred years. Along with the Heart Sutra and the Diamond Sutra, much of Mahayana Buddhism rests on these three sutras. Excuse me. So that's a very brief description of these sutras, and I have included sources in that article. Let me conclude by just saying this. There is nothing unreasonable in what has developed in Buddhism over the past 2,600 years. It is what we all do as human beings. We are always in a struggle to adapt what human life presents in a way that hopefully brings more comfort and agreement with how we want to live our lives. It is the nature of conditioned views to continue conditioned views. This is the motivation to seek a more visionary and mystical Dharma that motivated the Mahasanghikas, and it continues to today. An understanding of the Four Noble Truths clearly explains the how and why this occurs. The First Noble Truth states that dukkha occurs as a direct result of ignorance, of the origination of all manner of confusion and deluded thinking. The Second Noble Truth states that craving for and clinging to any object, event, view, or idea rooted in this initial ignorance of the Four Noble Truths will only continue dukkha. The Buddha presented the Dhamma in the form of Four Noble Truths to be understood and acted upon. He taught that to gain understanding, one would take refuge in the Buddha, the original Dhamma, and that Sangha, and the example of that. It is within refuge that understanding arises. Refuge is a place of safety and comfort. In taking refuge, one takes comfort in the understanding that a human being achieved profound understanding. He left his teachings, the Dhamma, so that others could do the same, and we take refuge in the Sangha, a well-focused community of practitioners developing what the Buddha taught. The transmission of the Dhamma occurs when a mind that has encountered the Four Noble Truths integrates the Eightfold Path leading to the cessation of dukkha. That's an authentic lineage of the transmission of the Buddha's teachings. This is what is referred to when the Buddha set the wheel of truth in motion at his first discourse, the Four Noble Truths. The preserved Dhamma originating in the Buddha is the means of transmission. So that's the end of the talk today. I hope that you find it beneficial in guiding your Dhamma practice. I hope you join me next week. Peace. Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.